So I'd ask for your careful attention then, brothers and sisters, as Brother James speaks to us on the subject, Proverbs, Wisdom for Today. Brother James.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Proverbs and wise sayings are found universally in human cultures. Like these examples of English proverbs, they express popular truths based on common sense and practical experience. It's not surprising then that God's people Israel had their own proverbs and wise sayings, although of course these weren't secular proverbs, they were proverbs which were rooted in the people's faith and their understanding of the Lord God. Now, reading through the book of Proverbs, its teachings can perhaps sometimes seem random or disconnected. The book of Proverbs isn't poetic like the Psalms. There isn't a narrative as in the historical books, and there's no argument to follow through as in some of Paul's letters. But I wanted to emphasize at the outset that, as these examples on the screen show, proverbial wisdom is still something which makes sense to us today. And the book of Proverbs is still highly relevant to us as we seek to live our lives today in the wisdom of God. So this evening we're going to divide our time into three parts, in which we'll look first at some background to the book of Proverbs. How can we define wisdom? What are the sources of wisdom? And looking at also the structure of the book of Proverbs. Secondly, we'll look at four ways in which the book of Proverbs teaches us to live wisely. And then finally, we'll look briefly beyond the book of Proverbs to see how it points forwards to Christ as the wisdom of God. And we'll look also at how godly wisdom remains relevant to us and our society today. So firstly then, some background to the book of Proverbs. The book of Proverbs can best be considered alongside Job and Ecclesiastes as a work of wisdom literature. And the tradition of Jewish wisdom writing continued after the completion of the Old Testament with wisdom writings such as the apocryphal Wisdom of Jesus Ben, that is son of Sirrah, also known as Ecclesiasticus or simply Sirach, and another work, The Wisdom of Solomon. But what is wisdom in the Old Testament context? So the word wisdom, most commonly translated in our English Bibles, is the Hebrew word chokmah, which has a number of different meanings. It can mean skill in craftsmanship, as here in Exodus 35, where Bezalel is said to have the artistic skill to work on the tabernacle. It can mean learning which comes through study, as here when it's used of false-hearted scribes who boast in their knowledge of God's law. And it can mean perceptiveness, as when David sees the woman of Tekoa and realizes that Joab has put her up to coming to see him. So the underlying sense of the word is skill that can be applied to a variety of spheres of life. But in the book of Proverbs, wisdom also takes on this moral quality, and it means something like skill in living, particularly living in harmony with God and with God's moral ordering of the world. Underlying this idea of wise living is the question of what is of value in human life. To live wisely, in the sense that Proverbs talks about wisdom, is to know what is really of true value and what isn't. So wisdom is about priorities, pursuing wisdom and understanding rather than seeking silver and gold, for example, as in Proverbs 16. How much better to get wisdom than gold? To get understanding is to be chosen rather than silver. In connection with this, we can think of Solomon, who was said to be wise simply because he chose wisdom rather than wealth and riches. Wisdom was his first priority. Wisdom is about choosing the right path, and the book of Proverbs frequently contrasts the path of wisdom and the path of foolishness. Walk in the way of the good and keep to the paths of the righteous. And wisdom means beginning with the fear of the Lord, as we've just read. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. It's the fear of the Lord which is the greatest value in life of all. And if we get that right, if we get that as our top priority, then other things will flow from that, will follow on. And so finally, in relation to this question, what is wisdom? Wisdom is something which should be manifested in a range of both practical and moral qualities. So think about those first verses in the book of Proverbs, which we've read together. And look at the range of different qualities which wisdom will lead to. It talks about qualities like insight and prudence, but also moral qualities like righteousness and justice. These are also aspects of wisdom, of wise living. So we can say that wisdom means things like exercising good judgment, making appropriate decisions, discerning priorities, planning for contingencies. These are all vitally important skills for living. They're important today just as much as they've ever been. But wisdom also means exercising those qualities, those good decision-making skills, those aspects of good judgment, exercising them in a godly way, in a way which begins with the fear of the Lord, and which is characterized by qualities like righteousness and justice and equity, which are fundamental aspects of God's character. And those are ideas that we'll come back to in a few moments as well. Now, I emphasized at the beginning that proverbs and wise sayings are universal to human cultures and societies. And wisdom literature, of which, as we've seen, the book of Proverbs is just one example, was particularly important right across the Near East at the time in Bible times. It's said of King Solomon, who consolidated and took forward the wisdom tradition in Israel, that God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure, so that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. And so this verse from 1 Kings 4 makes this express direct comparison between Solomon's God-given wisdom and the wisdom of two other ancient Near Eastern cultures, that of Mesopotamia to the east and that of Egypt to the west. We know of the wider cultural influences on Solomon's kingdom. The map, which you probably can't see very well, shows some of the trade connections which were established during the reign of Solomon with other nations. And so it's natural to suppose that Solomon and people in the kingdom of Israel at that time were aware of this kind of wider culture of wisdom writing, wisdom traditions. There are several surviving wisdom texts from ancient Egypt. Many of them share themes with the book of Proverbs, such as the instructions of an Egyptian civil servant to his son, in terms similar to the way that the book of Proverbs is sometimes expressed as a father speaking to his son. So, for example, there's a quotation here: "The teaching of life, to know how to return an answer to him who said it, and to direct a report to one who has sent him." And that might make us think of the book of Proverbs. Proverbs 15, "A soft answer turns away wrath." From Mesopotamia, there are fewer surviving texts, and most that do survive date from the Old Babylonian period, more than 1,500 years before Christ. And these texts deal mainly with practical matters, and for the most part don't seek to impart any moral guidance or ethical teachings. But without dwelling too much on those connections, I think it's helpful for us to be aware of this wider culture of wisdom writing. And as I said, it may be that Solomon and other compilers of the book of Proverbs adapted some of the wisdom that they found in other cultures, but obviously reformulated it in the context of their understanding of the God of Israel. Now, this leads us on to the question of where the book of Proverbs tells us are the sources of wisdom. And clearly, as we've seen, the starting point is God himself. It's the Lord who gives wisdom, who reveals his wisdom to human beings. But wisdom also comes in Proverbs from observation of how things are in the natural world, for example. Here in Proverbs 6, the busyness of the ant is taken as a warning against slothfulness, for example. And Proverbs takes its wisdom also from the observation of human behavior. For example, observing the overgrown vineyard of the sluggard. And some of these kinds of observations may have originated as popular sayings in Israel or as part of the wisdom traditions of other nations. But the important point that Proverbs emphasizes is that even wisdom which is derived from such observations of how things are in the world is ultimately still derived from the Lord. Because as Proverbs 20 tells us, the hearing ear and the seeing eye, the Lord has made them both. So it is the Lord who has made our ability to perceive things. He's given us the ability both to perceive physically, but also to make sense of what we see, to draw lessons, and therefore to gain wisdom. And so both directly and indirectly, it is God who is the source of all wisdom. But of course, when it comes to the book of Proverbs, This wisdom of God is mediated through those who collected together and compiled this wisdom, particularly King Solomon, who's identified at the start of chapters 1 and 10, and also in chapter 25, where we're told that the following proverbs were copied by the men of King Hezekiah. There are also authors who are otherwise unknown to us. Agur, son of Jacob, the mother of King Lemuel, who's the source of the final chapter, presumably including the instructions on an excellent wife. And finally, a couple of times, some of the proverbs are just generically attributed to the wise, so they don't have a specific author or source. But as I suggested before, even where there are specific authors mentioned by name, these authors weren't necessarily the first to come up with these proverbs. 1 Kings 4 says that King Solomon spoke 3,000 proverbs, but the verb doesn't necessarily mean he originated them. And the book of Proverbs itself repeatedly emphasizes the importance of seeking and acquiring knowledge from wherever it may be found, which is what Solomon and the other authors must have done under God's guidance. And one last point here is to note that a lot of the book of Proverbs comes in the form of instructions, as I referred to earlier, from a father to his son, also sometimes from a mother to her son, as in the case of King Lemuel. And whether this teaching was first communicated within a family setting, or, as has been suggested, whether it was perhaps taught in schools for young male trainee scribes, some of the book's teaching does seem particularly relevant to young men, particularly the teachings about avoiding slothfulness, or about avoiding the forbidden woman, or about, indeed, as I said, how to find a good wife. So in terms of structure, the book of Proverbs can be broken down quite straightforwardly into two main sections, and each section has a different type of wisdom material. The first section, from chapters 1 to 9, has a series of extended discourses about wisdom. Many of them, as I said, are in the form of instructions from a father to his son. And these are extended passages which tend either to be in praise of wisdom or warning against adultery. And they include in Proverbs 8 that extended chapter where wisdom calls, wisdom personified as a woman, calling aloud to everyone who will hear her. The second section of Proverbs, from chapter 10 to the end, tends to be mostly in the form of short sayings, the kind of sayings that we would typically refer to as proverbs or aphorisms, usually no more than one or two verses each. And as we've seen, there are various collections, sayings of Solomon, sayings of the wise, sayings of the mother of King Lemuel, and so on. But although sometimes you can see connections between a couple of proverbs which may appear next to each other, in general, there isn't a discernible connection between these different groups of proverbs. They stand alone in their own right. There's apparently no sequential argument or connected thought. So with all of that background in mind, let's turn our attention, secondly, to the message of the book of Proverbs. What does the book teach us about how to live wisely? And here I'm going to draw out four of the key lessons that I think Proverbs has for us about how to live wisely, four aspects of wise living according to Proverbs. The first one here we've already made reference to, and that's this: begin with the fear of the Lord. As we've seen, the expression, the fear of the Lord, occurs right at the opening of the book of Proverbs, and it's found a total of 14 times throughout the book. Its meaning is to acknowledge and respect the Lord as God, to stand in awe of him, and therefore to acknowledge one's place in creation before God as the maker and sustainer of everything, to acknowledge one's dependence on God. In Leviticus 19, God's people are told, "You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy." And so the qualities which God's people are to develop are the qualities that reflect God's holy character, the character of God himself. And that principle is found throughout the book of Proverbs, as for example here in Proverbs 14. "Whoever oppresses a poor man insults his maker, but he who is generous to the needy honours him." And again in Proverbs 17, "Whoever mocks the poor insults his maker." Oppressing or mocking the poor is an insult to God, who created all human beings in his image. And conversely, generosity to the poor shows honour to God as the maker of all human beings, the poor included. And so the basis for wise living in the book of Proverbs, the basis for caring for the poor and needy, the basis for doing justice, for all those other aspects of wisdom, the basis is the character of God. For example, when it comes to generosity to those in need, Proverbs tells us the Lord does not let the righteous go hungry. But if this is God's character, it's God's character not to let the righteous go hungry, there's also a responsibility on human beings to imitate this aspect of God's character. So Proverbs teaches us, whoever is generous to the poor lends to the Lord, and he will repay him for his deed. So those who seek to live wisely should act like God in being generous to those in need. Similarly, in its teachings on justice, Proverbs tells us the Lord maintains the widow's boundaries, but it also instructs its readers, do not move an ancient landmark. Now, what's interesting about both of these examples is that we can see that often in the book of Proverbs, the way that God acts on behalf of the poor, the way that he maintains the boundaries of ancient boundaries and so on, is precisely through his instructions to his people to do the same, to imitate his character. So in the first example, we see that those who treat the poor well will be rewarded by the Lord. While in the second example, those who move the ancient boundary stones will face the justice of God, who acts as the redeemer of widows and the fatherless. So the way in which God feeds the needy and upholds the cause of the poor is in part through his call for human beings to imitate his character and to live with these qualities, to live in fear of the Lord, to live in accordance with his character. We can see this again in Proverbs' teaching on fair business dealings. A just balance and scales are the Lord's, all the weights in the bag are his work. And if this is the case, then there's a corresponding responsibility on those who fear the Lord to ensure that their scales and weights are just, that they deal fairly in all aspects of their lives. We should act justly because God is just. This is what living in the fear of the Lord means. And as a final example, Proverbs teaches us that God delivers those who are in need. The name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous man runs into it and is safe. And the corresponding responsibility on us, rescue those who are being taken away to death. Hold back those who are stumbling to the slaughter. If you say, behold, we did not know this, does not he who weighs the heart perceive it? Does not he who keeps watch over your soul know it? And will he not repay man according to his work? And so, again, we have this idea that God's knowledge of the human heart and his ultimate justice stand behind these instructions to human beings to reflect his character by rescuing those in need. And in this sense, the concept of the fear of the Lord may include an awareness of the judgment to come, particularly for those who are inclined to turn away from the path of righteousness. But fundamentally, living in the fear of the Lord is not just about living in fear of judgment. It means living with God's character as the basis of one's life and actions. And those who live in the fear of the Lord are assured that that God will be close to them. Proverbs 15, the Lord is far from the wicked, but he hears the prayer of the righteous. And again in Proverbs 2, he is a shield to those who walk in integrity, guarding the paths of justice and watching over the way of his saints. So far from distancing us from God, as might be suggested by the word fear, living in the fear of the Lord actually means living in a close relationship with God, God who hears the prayers of the righteous and watches over the way of his saints. So according to the book of Proverbs, this close relationship with God and this dependence on God is the first step in wise living. The book of Proverbs presupposes that since God is both creator and sustainer of everything, there's a fundamental moral order to the way that the universe operates. That's not to say that the present order of things is perfectly in harmony with God's character and God's justice, and we'll come back to ways in which it's not in a moment. But what it does mean is that we live in a world of cause and effect, where actions have consequences, and where, by and large, for the most part, good actions have positive consequences, and bad actions have negative consequences. And this is true on a number of levels. At its most basic level, it means that in the natural course of daily life, we often find that wise living brings its own rewards and foolish living leads to disaster. So, for example, a slack hand causes poverty, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. And at a very basic level, again, in the normal course of things, we find this to be true. Hard work produces wealth, while laziness leads to poverty and ruin. When it comes to the consequences of evil or foolish behaviour, there are several proverbs which indicate that foolishness will lead to its own ruin. For example, Proverbs 26, whoever digs a pit will fall into it, and a stone will come back on him who starts it rolling. So the proverb implies that those who plan mischief for others will often find themselves the victims of their own contrivances. Similarly, in Proverbs 18, a fool's mouth is his ruin and his lips are a snare to his soul. We have this implication that foolish speaking will very often of its own accord lead to disaster for the person who speaks in such a way. On another level, we find God is said to be directly involved in maintaining the moral order of the universe by bringing down the wicked and by blessing those who fear him. So Proverbs 3, the Lord's curse is on the house of the wicked, but he blesses the dwelling of the righteous. And sometimes God's blessings are expressed in very tangible, present-day material ways. So Proverbs 3, honour the Lord with your wealth and with the first fruits of all your produce, then your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will be bursting with wine. And so honouring God with your wealth is said to bring abundance and material blessings in the present. But there's also a final level on which Proverbs teaches us that God will ensure that the moral order he's created will prevail, and that's in that ultimate future sense. So Proverbs 24 promises, if you find wisdom, there will be a future, and your hope will not be cut off. And in the same chapter, we have these verses. Fret not yourself because of evildoers, and be not envious of the wicked, for the evil man has no future. The lamp of the wicked will be put out. It's interesting that this verse actually acknowledges that there are evildoers in the present. Fret not yourself for evildoers implies that sometimes there are evildoers about whom we're inclined to fret ourselves. But it does assure us that in the end, in the future, God's justice will prevail, even when it appears not to prevail in the present. So clearly then, Proverbs are not intended to be promises or guarantees of rewards in the present. Clearly, sometimes there are evildoers who prevail. There are diligent people who are poor. There are sluggards who find themselves to be wealthy. And as I said, we'll come back to these apparent injustices in a moment. So the book of Proverbs doesn't promote a very simplistic prosperity gospel where untold riches are promised in the present for those who follow God's ways. By nature, by definition really, Proverbs are generalizations. They indicate what is generally true for most people most of the time, all other things being equal. For example, the proverb, train up a child in the way he should go, even when he is old, he will not depart from it. That will generally hold true, all other things being equal. But of course, other things are not always equal. Pressure from the world to conform, pressure from bad company, pressure from the sinful desires of the heart, all these things, which Proverbs is only too well aware of, may turn a child away from the path of righteousness. But the important point to hold on to is that Proverbs teaches us that living wisely means living as far as possible within the context of this kind of moral framework that God has established in the world. It means seeking to work hard. The fact that sometimes hard work doesn't produce good results doesn't mean we should give up on hard work. It means not speaking foolishly. It means honouring God with our wealth. It means living as if God's moral order prevails, even when sometimes it may seem not to. And finally, it means also that since this is God's moral order, not our own, we shouldn't take punishment or retribution into our own hands. We shouldn't seek to redress now wrongs that we suffer in the present. Proverbs 25 teaches us, if your enemy is hungry, give him bread to eat. If he is thirsty, give him water to drink, for you will heap burning coals on his head, and the Lord will reward you. And the point is that even when evil seems to prevail in the present age, we, rather than taking matters into our own hands, we keep trusting in God's ultimate deliverance and justice, God's ultimate reward, which will be here in the coming age. What we've seen so far now leads us to a third aspect of Proverbs' teaching on wise living that I want to focus on. That's exercise godly discernment. Now, firstly, it's important to say that the book of Proverbs counsels against trusting in one's own mind. The source of wisdom is God, And rather than trusting in our own minds, we should trust in God's wisdom. Whoever trusts in his own mind is a fool, but he who walks in wisdom will be delivered. But that doesn't mean we give up our individual responsibility to think through and apply the principles of God's wisdom in our own lives and circumstances. Because Proverbs in and of themselves are not wisdom. As we've seen, wisdom means discerning what is of value in life, choosing the right path, and emulating God's character. Wisdom is a way of life. Proverbs 26 tells us, like a thorn that goes up into the hand of a drunkard is a proverb in the mouth of fools. So it's possible to know proverbs, to know wise sayings, to have this resource of wise teaching, but still be a fool. Fundamentally, as we've seen, wisdom is not about learning rules, but about developing one's character in accordance with God's character. And from this development of character will flow the ability to live by and apply wise teachings in daily life. But this comes back to the main point of this section. This requires the exercise of godly discernment to know when is the right time to apply a particular teaching or to use a particular proverb. And in this context, I think it's important to note that proverbs are intended as principles and observations about life, not unbreakable rules. We've already touched on this when we noted that not all hard work is rewarded, and not all slothfulness leads to disaster. Generally it does, but not always. And so proverbs have to be balanced against one another. This is particularly clear in the case of these two proverbs from Proverbs 26. Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. And I'd suggest that these two proverbs may have been deliberately set against one another here in order to draw attention to the fact that each one has to be applied in an appropriate way. We have the same kind of contradiction in the proverbs that we have in English today. One of the English proverbs I quoted right at the start is many hands make light work. But it's equally the case that too many cooks spoil the broth. Both of these proverbs are true in different contexts and at different times. And wisdom is knowing when to use one and when to use the other. And returning to the biblical proverbs, some proverbs may not be intended to be applied at all. Proverbs 17 tells us, a bribe is like a magic stone in the eyes of the one who gives it. Wherever he turns, he prospers. Now, this is clearly not intended as an exhortation to practice bribery. It's simply an observation of the effectiveness of bribery in certain situations. And against this, we would want to set a proverb like this one, which comes later in the same chapter, the wicked accepts a bribe in secret to pervert the ways of justice. As an example of the need to exercise godly discernment in the application of Proverbs, we can take the book of Proverbs teaching on a time to speak, to borrow a phrase from Ecclesiastes. So Proverbs teaches us that there are right times to speak, Proverbs 15, to make an apt answer is a joy to a man, and a word in season, how good it is. Similarly, in Proverbs 25, a word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in a setting of silver. But there's also a time, as Ecclesiastes says, to keep silence. So Proverbs 27, whoever blesses his neighbour with a loud voice rising early in the morning will be counted as cursing. So wisdom means knowing when to speak and when to keep silence. It means applying the principles of divine wisdom in a way which involves discernment. But it means exercising this discernment not just through simple human judgment, but through developing a character which seeks to imitate the character of God, a character which is living in the fear of the Lord. So we come to the fourth way that I wanted to highlight in which the book of Proverbs teaches us to live wisely. And the final way is this: wisdom means trusting in the Lord, whatever happens in life. Now, as I hinted before, it's sometimes been suggested that the book of Proverbs is quite naive or simplistic about the way that it depicts this kind of cause-effect relationship. It's been suggested that Proverbs teaches only that righteousness leads to blessing and evil doing leads to destruction. That is sometimes how it seems to be interpreted. But as we've already seen, the book of Proverbs is actually much more realistic and much more nuanced about the way things are. It recognizes that sometimes righteous people can be poor while evildoers prosper. Verses like this one, better is a poor man who walks in integrity than a rich man who is crooked in his ways. indicate that there are poor people who walk in integrity and rich people who are crooked. Walking in integrity doesn't always lead to riches. Proverbs 22 indicates that there are many poor people who are deserving of the Lord's help, and who are therefore not simply poor because they've been foolish or slothful. Do not rob the poor because he is poor, for the Lord will plead their cause. And as we've seen all the way through Proverbs, there's an emphasis of God being on the side of the poor and helping the poor. So poverty isn't always a result of slothfulness. And Proverbs recognises also that in a complex world, sometimes it's necessary to make a choice between riches and moral character. The two don't always go hand in hand. And so where there is a conflict between those two things, a good name is to be chosen rather than great riches. And what's more, there's a really large number of Proverbs which which emphasise the fact that God's ways are ultimately inscrutable, and that therefore one cannot always predict a simple relationship between cause and consequences. Proverbs 16 is typical. The heart of man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his steps. Similarly, Proverbs 19. Many are the plans in the mind of a man, but it is the purpose of the Lord that will stand. And Proverbs 21. The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he will. And finally, also in Proverbs 21, we have these verses which emphasize that no matter how much we may prepare for something, it is God alone who could bring it to pass. No wisdom, no understanding, no counsel can avail against the Lord. The horse is made ready for the day of battle, but the victory belongs to the Lord. And those are just a few examples of this emphasis in Proverbs on the ultimate mystery or inscrutability of God's work in the universe. And these verses reflect a wider questioning which comes later on in the books of Job and Ecclesiastes about the ultimate unknowability by human beings of the details of God's purposes in the world. And yet, while the book of Proverbs recognises and acknowledges this complexity of the world as it really is, a world where the wicked often do prosper and where God's ways are beyond our understanding, nevertheless, as we've also seen, the book of Proverbs holds out an ultimate hope for those who trust in the Lord and follow the path of righteousness. A righteous person may fall, but in the bigger picture, these falls are only setbacks. For the righteous falls seven times and rises again, but the wicked stumble in times of calamity. And so for a righteous person, each time they fall, they will rise again. And the path of righteousness eventually leads away from death to life. In the path of righteousness is life, and in its pathway there is no death. And Proverbs 15, the path of life leads upwards for the prudent, that he may turn away from Sheol beneath. And so Proverbs teaches us that whatever happens in life, and however far from the moral order that God has established we may feel ourselves to be, we shouldn't lean on our own understanding, but on the Lord, who will ultimately bring us along straight paths to his kingdom. Proverbs 3, trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make straight your paths. And so with that final lesson in wise living from the book of Proverbs, we turn to our final section, looking at wisdom beyond the book of Proverbs. And when we turn to the New Testament, we find, of course, that the language of wisdom is applied to the Lord Jesus Christ himself. In fact, it can be argued that, among other things, Jesus came as a teacher of God's wisdom. Paul refers to Jesus as the power of God and the wisdom of God, a phrase that indicates that Jesus embodies God's power and wisdom as he does all the other qualities of God's character. And Jesus seems to make the same claim for himself when he refers in Matthew 11 to wisdom being justified by her deeds. It's his deeds which are the deeds of wisdom. Later on in Matthew 12, Jesus says that his teaching is greater than the wisdom of Solomon. And in Matthew 13, the people of his hometown of Nazareth ask, where did this man get this wisdom and these mighty works? They recognize Jesus as the teacher of wisdom. In fact, a high proportion of the teaching of Jesus recorded in the Gospels can be defined in a broad sense as wisdom teaching. The parables, the aphorisms, the proverbs, even the Beatitudes all follow structures which are typical of later Jewish, both of the book of Proverbs and also of later Jewish wisdom writing. And when we think about the content of Jesus' message, we can see that Jesus didn't only come to preach the message of salvation and of the kingdom of God. He also came to teach us how to live now, how to live in wisdom now, so as to be prepared for the kingdom by living now under God's rule in our lives. We perhaps don't often think about this idea of wisdom as often as we could, for example. We usually think more in terms of the categories of sin and salvation, which raise discussion of moral questions and ethical questions, but not in this really broad way that the idea of wisdom allows us to consider moral and ethical questions. Because, as we've seen this evening, wisdom is all about the skill in living one's daily life, in all its choices and decisions, in all its practicalities and mundane activities, but living in everything in the fear of the Lord, that is, with God's character as the basis for life. And as such, wisdom gives us guidance for thinking about some very down-to-earth practical issues, like not waking up your neighbour too early in the morning, while also setting out some fundamental principles that can help transform our characters to become more like the people that God wants us to be. One writer has expressed the interplay between Old Testament prophetic and wisdom traditions like this. The wisdom tradition values life, creativity and well-being, even in the midst of injustice and struggle. So while the prophets pointed to the better world to come, the wisdom teachers taught how to live now, even with all the injustices that exist until the kingdom comes. And so wisdom, both in its practical sense and in the sense of its overall message about God, is therefore something which, in a sense, is for all human beings. Remember, we looked at the beginning at how wisdom has been a feature of all human cultures, including those across the Near East at the time Proverbs was written. And the book of Proverbs therefore has an appeal which, even in Solomon's time, stretched way beyond the borders of Israel. We read in 1 Kings 4 that people of all nations came to hear the wisdom of Solomon, the kind of wisdom that we find in the book of Proverbs. We've also seen that Proverbs doesn't express its wisdom in terms specific to the covenant people of Israel, but instead the fact that God is the maker of all human beings is taken as the basis for our response to him. And we've seen that God's wisdom cries out from the heights and from the crossroads, that passage in Proverbs 8, calling aloud for all people to learn from her. And so I suggest that this leads us to the conclusion that we too should be seeking not only to walk in wisdom's way ourselves, but also to join in wisdom's call to all people in a world which seems to have departed so far from the path of wisdom. And in joining wisdom's call, what we're calling people to is not only a hope in the coming kingdom, but also calling people to join wisdom's way now, to live now in the fear of the Lord, and to walk as we ourselves seek to do, not according to our own understanding, but in a trusting dependence in God in all things. Mm-hmm.